morning. I'll reconvene the hearing. Now, this back to Galloway, that's the day dedicated to I suppose it's the easiest way to refer to it. Just before I ask you to present your submissions, there is a point that I raised you today with the council, but thinking about overnight, I think it's sort of more significant than I thought. As I understand it, the data set for the structure plan at the moment is held by Jack's Point. That needs to be provided to the council so they can do the alterations, because if we are going to do any amendments to it as part of our decision making process, we're not doing that through Jack's Point.
No.
I can make that quite clear.
Yeah.
And we have arranged with the council that we will have a staff member who has a confidentiality arrangement who will deal with these things, so it needs to be probably provided relatively quickly so he can learn how to manipulate it, if you like.
Yes, I mean, my intent was that that was, had either already been done or was on the verge of being done, so there's no concern or issue with that.
Right,
that's
good.
Now, the other technical things need to be done before it was in the form that anybody could manipulate, so
yes.
It can be done now.
Yeah. The other thought that occurred to me is that there are a number of areas that Commissioner Nixon has very kindly referred to as amoeba floating around on the structure plan, and I have doubts that any consent plan could actually verify that an application is complied with some of those. The solution appears to me to be that the grid references of all the photons should actually be listed and identified as part of the structure plan, probably with a centroid as well. Then anyone can go to the GPS and actually locate it.
Mm.
At the moment, I think we need an expert. We will need an expert on the 27th to show us where these places are.
Well, on that point, they will be pegged on the 27th, aren't they?
And
you, they're right, this GPS.
Yes, using whatever is the latest grid reference
we
use in this country.
Yeah.
Yes, it seems to me that as a public document that has to be available for anyone
to understand.
And I'll be making the same request of more with theirs.
That's very good. Thank you.
So
you have my legal submission. I have some spare paper copies, but I presume you've got your copies. Would you like a copy?
I would love a copy.
And there are two appendices. This set only has the small appendix, which is just a mat. The second appendix is the constitution of the Jack's Point Residents Funding Association. So I think that's good, so I don't have printed it out yet, but if then it's publicly available, but it's definitely copies we can get those made available.
Yes. The screen task really carefully put the whole lot together, and I think it came up to 260 something pages.
Yes.
So
I thought it was not print that for no reason.
Yes.
But it is available if people need it, we can get copies brought up. And partway through my submissions at the appropriate point, we'll talk about this version of the structure plan. And I've got some copies from it'll be formally produced by Mr. Tapar, but it'll be useful for you to have them while I have my legal submissions.
Okay.
And so just to be clear, that copy out there is Jack's Point, the JGRI's version of the structure plan.
Yes.
So that I'm just understanding it's from the structure.
Is it titled that?
It probably isn't because of everything else that was going on last night.
You could look at doing some headlines about it.
Yeah, because,
just make it clear.
Just get the date reference as well, I think.
Thank you.
So these legal submissions are on behalf of both the Great Jack's Point Entities and the Jack's Point Residents and Owners Association. This is a separate submission. And in paragraph two, I explain the role of JPRLA in summary. It's going to be presented to you in the evidence of Mike Coburn. It was a body set up to operate and maintain the communal infrastructure, the checkpoint zone, community facilities and the open space in the zone. It also regulates house and landscape design and has an official role in its constitution to represent the interests of its members and the development of the community in context such as this. And the JPRLA confirms its support for the positions here in these submissions and the evidence presented to the checkpoint in the JPRLA. So my submissions cover the relevant history of the development of the zone, an overview of the relevant history of PC 44 and the JPD as notified in the post-district plan, a summary of the relief now sought, and there will be some updates in response to issues that were traversed yesterday as well to add to that. The key issues that I believe are for your consideration to try and assist. Summary of the statutory considerations and a section at the end on setting out where there is scope for the major changes since the plan was notified. In terms of the history of the zone became partially operative in October 2004 and fully operative in 2006. And the study sets out a detailed history of the developments of the zone to date. Being the director, experienced master planner, landscape architect and representative of the Jack's Point Submitter Group. And the vision for the zone was set way back and recorded in 2003 in the stakeholders' deed that was referred to yesterday between the council, the Jack's Point, again the identity and the Jardines. And the vision was to enable and achieve development of the Coneburn lands to create exceptional living environments and village communities centred around and based upon space, natural and recreational values. And that vision was agreed to between the council and the landowners at the time, including Jack's Point, and the Section 42A report has appended it for reference. Over the last 10 years, as the zone has developed, the needs and demands of the community have also changed, and the Oxford plan regime in place has been well tested, and experience showing which aspects of the planning regime work well in terms of efficiently enabling quality of the design, landscape and energy outcomes, and which aspects of it could be improved upon. A significant proportion of the zone is still owned by the Jack's Point Group entities, as shown in the ownership plan appended to Mr. Gardy's evidence. So just note that there, as evidence in chief appended the plan that did not include the Homestead Bay section of the zone. So in that version of the plan, it shows the Jack's Point entities as owning approximately 50% of the zone. You'll present an updated version of that plan today that does include Homestead Bay. And with that added on, that shows the Jack's Point entity zone 44% of the zone. And about 11% so far is in ownership of JPRLA. So that's that communal open space, amenity areas, infrastructure lands and so on.
On that plan, one of the orange lines that just sort of runs top of the screen.
They are roads, legal roads. So that's Warship Road coming from the State Highway. And there's an unformed legal road, which is the other one.
Right, okay.
And that's it, which is why it's got the orange cap cut, which is Crown Land. So there's also some other Crown Lands. QEC slash Crown Land.
Right.
And again.
Yes.
The developer of Jack's Point, informed by experience today both at Jack's Point and around New Zealand, seeks to improve the planning provisions of the Jack's Point zone to better enable the full vision for the zone to be realised, and in particular to ensure that the zone continues to evolve towards the objective of a self-sustaining community, with a vibrant village serving many needs of the residents and visitors, including commercial, retail, employment, health, education, diversity of dwelling types and visitor accommodation. Retention of the high quality urban residential settings that have been achieved to date, and provision of additional preserved home sites and corresponding protection and enhancement of the natural and open spaces of the majority of the land in the zone. The Jack's Point zone provisions are not set in stone, and district plans are required to be reviewed every 10 years. The Queenstown area has changed markedly in the last 10 years, as have the needs of the community. And Jack's Point and JPRLA are seeking that the council district plan review be amended so that the zone can be sufficiently developed to its completion, consistent with the high standard of urban design, landscape and energy outcomes achieved to date, so that the zone can come into its own and play the role envisaged for it in the wider community and economy.
Excuse me, I just wanted to ask something now because it relates to the submission we're going to be hearing in the next few days from Brabant et al.
Yes.
Now, related to that is this issue with the RCL land. Have they always been in separate ownership? And obviously you folks have got a significant interest in what they're doing on their land because you've submitted, particularly on density issues and things like that. So,
Mr. Dowdy is probably the better person to answer that question in terms of have they always been in separate ownership. They have been for some time, but I couldn't tell you exactly how long.
The reason I raise that is that Jack's point sort of started out as a particular vision, but this sort of seems to have emerged somewhere along the line.
The Jack's point deed, that 2003 stakeholder deed in 2003, that's between the then three landowners, the Jardines, which is Homestead Bay, Henley Downs, which is but it doesn't exactly match up, but it's some overlap with the RCL land now, and Jack's Point.
Okay.
So they were the three original landowners of the whole zone.
Well, I'll leave that for Mr.
Yeah.
Darby.
Yes, yeah, thanks. Paragraph 9, changes to the nature and scale of development in the zone in order to reach completion have been squarely anticipated since the zone's inception. It is unrealistic and unwise for a developer to not learn the movement of time, but instead to constantly strive to ensure optimum outcomes, especially for such an important and highly valued place such as Jack's Point. The fact that it has always been expected there will be a need to change and evolve the ultimate vision for the zone's full development is illustrated by the suite of non-objection obligations that were placed upon and accepted by the purchasers and our residents through the various covenants and the JPROA's constitution. And as confirmed in the Environment Court in the Coneburn case, which was assessing a particular non-object covenant in the context of a resource consent application in the zone, it's entirely appropriate and important for the purpose of the RMA for a relationship between developer and residents to be regulated by non-objection requirements to give the developer the flexibility to complete development. And now, 10 years on from the zone becoming operative, the developer is seeking to do just that, put in place a planning framework that will set up the appropriate framework for completion so the final vision can be realised. Additionally, one of the core institutions that is integral to the development, servicing and management of Jack's Point is the JPROA, which runs in accordance with its constitution attached to my legal submissions. Its objects are to act for the benefit of Jack's Point, which is a defined term, and the members of the JPROA by creating guidelines and giving oversight of policy and design outcomes, collecting levies in order to provide and maintain core community infrastructure utilities, specifically roads, water supply, wastewater treatment and service lines, and communal facilities, which is also defined, and ensuring the observance of bylaws and covenants, which act in addition to the district plan requirements to ensure high quality living outcomes for the zone. JPROA also has one of its objects, taking action with QOEC in circumstances where the issues affect or impact society, its members, the communal facilities and your Jack's Point, hence JPROA is involved in the DPR process. And while Jack's Point is in development phase, the controlling member is the developer. In order to ensure that the role of JPROA plays complements and does not undermine the completion of the development of the zone and associated infrastructure. And the core roles of the JPROA and its functions are further addressed in the evidence of Mr. Coburn and King Germain, more specifically in respect to the private infrastructure and utilities that service the Jack's Point the zone. The recent planning history and development of the zone provisions from before the operative plan resort chapter through PC44 over only part of the JPZ to now are set out in the evidence of Mr. Ferguson from paragraph 4.1, and I'm not going to repeat those details in these submissions. I just want to make one minor correction to Ms. Scott's opening submissions about the phase of appeals of PC44. And that one of the three appeals was withdrawn. So it's not a big issue, but just to get the record straight. So there are two outstanding appeals that are subject to without prejudice negotiations. Paragraph 14. Of particular importance, and as discussed by Mr. Ferguson from paragraph 417, is the result of significant consultation with and collaboration between Council and Jack's Point. Working with council, Jacksport undertook the preparation of the new Chapter 41 provisions there notified, including the new structure plan and formulated the changes to Chapter 27 and prepared the associated Section 32 report. This work involved an update to the Coneburn resource study, which is addressed in the Darby's evidence as well, and an assessment of landscape and visual effects. That was quite optimistical. For council's review and acceptance. Following a period of consultation, review and editing from the council, the final package was incorporated into the DPR by council when it was notified on 26 August 2015. And other major holders, including RCL, were invited to take part in the drafting of those planned provisions in Section 32 evaluation. And before Chapter 41 is publicly notified, council was presented with a recommending report which presented the JPD chapter to be notified. Within this report, one of the key reasons for recommending Chapter 41 as being included in Stage 1 rather than Stage 2 was that a large volume of resource consent was generated for single house development in Jack's Point, and the consent process essentially duplicates the design review process that occurs. This creates an unnecessary burden both on the applicant and the council. In addition, Jack's Point has revisited its future development aspirations and changes to the structure plan and associated provisions are required. The report to council, when assessing the options, noted in respect of option 1 of retaining the status quo that there were no advantages, and that the disadvantages of retaining the status quo were that similar burden of the unnecessary resource consents and the inability to realise the future development aspirations without a complex and risky resource consent process. The advantages of notifying the new Chapter 41 were noted to be that it will reduce the consenting burden for the applicant and council, will provide Jack's Point revised development plans and involves minimal reworking of other provisions, saving time and costs to make changes and justify them. And further noted that the recommended option mitigates risk as it will help support economic well-being in particular, whilst at the same time giving sensitive consideration to the environment, including the landscape values of the district. And it confirms that the recommended option is consistent with the policies in the annual plan, the LTEC, the long-term plan and economic development strategy, and that under the Local Government Act, purpose and provisions, the recommended option will help meet the current and future needs of communities with good quality local infrastructure, local public services and performance of regulatory functions in a way that is most cost effective for households and businesses by streamlining the consent processes and reducing the need for unnecessary resource consents.
Do these things ever stay concrete?
I don't know.
They're all self-fulfilling prophecy.
It was approved at the 30 June meeting on the basis of those recommendations. And given this history of working with the council, it was puzzling and concerning to see some respect material changes in the Section 42A report. However, through that informal caucus thing leading up to 3 February, it seems now there is largely alignment between the experts on the issues and the further caucusing and since then further alignment. So through that process, I think we helpfully come to a position where there any points of difference are unminimal and will hopefully be clear to you so that you can make your determination on those.
Just one interesting observation from my point of view on that, and I don't want to get dragged into PC 44, but a group of commissioners heard PC 44, came to a conclusion, and they particularly wanted to exclude the EIC and the FB1 and 2. Other than that, they largely adopted what is now being proposed. But when it was notified as a plan, it included FB1 and 2 and the EIC, which is a raging mystery to me. And of course, that's through the process that's been going on the last few months. We're actually facing back to the position that the commissioners originally recommended, in large part, aren't we?
Well, no, it's a different position. It's like a middle position almost. So EIC has gone, but that area of land was still to be developed as residential, and the function that EIC was intended to perform is consolidated into the village. And FP1 is not gone because we've still got EC1 and 2, in total 22 house sites rather than open space, which is the optimal position.
Right.
So it's a version in between of triangulated version.
Yeah, no, I was a little unclear as to why the council notified it with those, with EIC and the, what permission for it rejected. It did seem a little odd, but however, it's
the timing, just in case it's relevant, the plan provisions were accepted by the council before the BC 44 decision issue.
Oh, okay. That'll explain it. Thank you.
Down to paragraph 23, as part of its leadership role, the JPRA in particular has undertaken an exercise of contacting many submitters who are residents in the zone to discuss their submissions and preferred options to address matters raised. That was also a positive process, and set of provisions as tabled in the 3 February evidence to address to the extent possible matters raised by submitters while still ensuring the goal of fully developing the zone can be realised. As we recall, Jack's point filed a memorandum with the hearings panel and service on all submitters outlining critical changes to the release source in order to address some matters raised by submitters. And the intent of filing in December was to provide sufficient time for council and submitters to absorb the amended relief prior to completion of the 42A report from 20 January and evidence exchange so that this hearing is as efficient as possible, with focus able to be brought easily on matters that remain outstanding. So in summary, following the relevant critical points tonight. Jack's point has committed considerable resources in the form of time, cost, leadership and vision towards the council district being a new process. Council and Jack's point began a very early engagement preparing to notify Chapter 41 in order to get to a position where its core objectives were considered to be the most appropriate to achieve the purpose of the Act. The council has accepted the council staff recommendation recommending notification of Chapter 41 as part of the district plan review due to the benefits of reducing costs of current consent process for both council and homeowners under the operative regime, as well as to align the plan provisions with the intended development of the zone, streamline consent processes and remove the need for unnecessary consent. The council staff also recorded that Chapter 41 will help support economic well-being, particularly whilst at the same time giving sensitive considerations to the environment,
in
the landscape
areas
for the district.
What weight should we really give to A and B?
What weight?
Yes. I mean, does that have any weight on our decision-making process? I mean, obviously, that comes in terms of resources.
It's not relevant to a legal test. It's just a point I want to emphasise. It's an incredibly important piece of land that has to be developed in a sensible way, and the commitment, Jack's point, the commitment to that is illustrated by, in part, the resources that it's put into the process to date.
Now, in that quote that you put there, will help supporting economic well-being, could they present as part of that report any of the critical evidence to base their opinion on?
The council staff?
Yes, or anyone?
No. And the CTI report, it follows the format required by council. So,
yeah, I know. It's just named it from the boxes.
To a certain extent, the format of the zone, you know, you were asking whether there's going to be some questions today about the structure of the chapter. Again, that was, you know, we were required to fit the format that the council had set up for its district plan, so
that's the
format we were working with both in terms of the plan provision being the Section 32.
I see our role is to see if we can make it even better.
Yes.
Rather than criticise where we've come from. But in that particular instance, I was just wondering, while they've said that we'll support economic well-being, did they actually provide any evidence?
So what I might give you now is the updated structure plan, which Mr. Tapar will formally present to his ego. Do you want an A3 version or an A2 version?
Which is as legible.
Well, this is the best probably.
Okay, that's good.
Okay,
and
we've got black and white versions of both A2 and A3.
And we've got the AL and the
wall. Thank you.
And we've got the one on the
We've got the A1. Yeah.
A1.
Because of what, whatever the printer does to us.
Right, so this is...
You've got the two-scale A2
versions. Yep, good. Yep. Yeah.
So there are four key changes to this compared to the three February version of the Edison's paper, Edison's sheet. So one matter that simply required correcting from even the notified version was that even though there was table names noted in the legends, table names overlay,
yes,
there was actually no distinction between what that was, so now it's the little subtle dots.
Yeah. Might be one of the improvements we do when we
actually
yeah, our staff people working on it.
So that's been fixed, that really identified now in some form.
Yeah.
And that follows the again Mr. Duffy, Mr. Takara and Yvonne Pfluger can give evidence of this, follows the table length character landscape logging.
Yeah.
And there are policies that refer to that, but there is actually a couple of rules as well. Just to pick up on something Ms. Jones said yesterday, there's a couple of rules about tennis courts and swimming pools that directly relate to the table.
They're not complying.
Yes, something like that, yeah. Yep. So that's change number one. Change number two, as of the meeting with Dr. Reed yesterday, house sites 51, 52 and 53 have been moved. And there will be the signed caucusing statements, which I have confirming agreements on that point. So 51 was here and has now moved to there, 51A.
Right. So 51 is shown, but the light of the light means that it's been reversed.
Yes. Yeah, that's just to show you where it was.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then directly above that, 52 has only moved a little bit to 52A. And 53. Has now moved, you're watching all the way across to there.
Yeah, just below this thing.
Yeah. So there's that. And then something that I think it was Mr. Nixon picked up on yesterday, whilst we had the hatched open space corridor, if you like, it had been dropped off the legend. So that is just back on the legend open space.
Yes, I think the distinction was that the council version, section 42A version, showed it actually as OSA.
Oh, right.
There were two lines, but it was very narrow.
Yeah, okay.
That was what led to my questions, is that it should be a minimum width.
Yeah. Because, I mean, the rules that refer to that, it's generally in accordance with, or even most of the best, linked to the rules, so that's why it hatches was all that was sort of required to give the indicative location. And the final change, which I think Mr. Coburn will be able to explain, is in relation to the boundary of B has been sharpened up, whereas it used to be round, and it's in relation to a small triangle of land there.
That's the point A of the hectare that RPL want rezoned to HDB, is it?
Yes.
So that is a point of difference.
It is a point of difference, yeah.
Between Jack's point and RPL.
Yes, or JPROA more specifically.
Yeah.
JPROA. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So that, so, yeah, so more evidence will be led, or not led, led in the summary, the evidence addresses those changes as well. Is there any other change? Actually, the questions about the structure plan just while I'm on my feet.
Oh, just one thing, bullshit right there, regards to yesterday, that, I presume that's going to stay in its current alignment and just developed as a spine road, so it will become a, it's going to stay as a permanent feature.
Yes, no, it's definitely intended as a permanent primary access route through the zone.
Yeah.
Its alignment is being tweaked at the moment in terms of where the legal road goes, the local government process has been kicked off to move it, but not materially, it still is, in general, you know, I think, the zone provisions require that it can be moved 120 metres outside.
Yeah.
While still complying with the provisions, so it's still the revised alignment for the legal road is still within that corridor.
Okay. And that's not subject to debate. There's no argument about that between Checkpoint and
RCA. No, not that I understand. Yeah. And it's a separate process, and it's in accordance with the zone provisions. Yeah. And the other point that we have nearly completed is the witnesses are still focusing on defining the O&L line as it relates to the structure plan. So they, at the moment they've managed to define it as it relates to the boundary of RHDF, and that's attached to their caucusing statements, which I'll be handing up. But they're still just doing the technical work that's required to show it as it relates to the rest of the structure plan.
Mm.
So that's coming as a caucus document.
Judge Jackson's highlighter covers about 500 metres.
Yeah. Yeah. Anything else? I think I'm happy to come back up.
That's very helpful to see.
So, updated relief package. One of the key aspects of the zone is the removal of the requirement for outline development plans as an interim step in the planning approval process. In its place is a more refined and detailed structure plan that combines with both regulatory and non-regulatory controls on subdivision, utility types and building location, scale and design. And embedded in the Checkpoint set of controls is the requirement that buildings in the RJP activity areas and the preserved home sites continue to be required to go through the separate design review process in compliance with the relevant design guidelines, which is explained in the evidence from Mr. Coburn.
Does that requirement need to be on the district plan?
Well, the package, as you know, that we've proposed for the new preserved home site is that their activity status is also contingent upon that same requirement being registered over those sites. So currently it's not registered because there's no development there. And it does give the council a measure of certainty and the standard needs to be required with, and if it's not complied with, the utility status gets bumped up. So I think it is a relevant measure that you can evaluate for its effectiveness based on the evidence about how it's worked to date and the structures that it's set up to ensure it works, and the fact that it's required that a member of council is also on the design review board. So I think all of those factors integrate to the district planning process in a way that does make it that relevant to your evaluation. The paragraph 27, the complete package is now proposed and summarised below in my submission, will provide the basis for the integrated management of the spatial layout and development of activities and buildings across the zone. The placement of activity areas in the structure plan take into account detailed assessment of constraints in order to protect existing urban amenities, natural landscape values and water quality. The location and extent of activity areas also takes into account topography and infrastructure requirements and reflects an extensive master planning approach based on designing the optimal town that protects its surrounding natural landscape values and only places development in accordance with each area's capacity to absorb change. The structure plan provides a logical spatial positioning for the range of activities needed to support a fully integrated, self-sufficient community, meeting all needs, be they health, education, employment, leisure and entertainment for all ages, all linked by crucial primary and secondary road access through the zone, public access roads through the zone and strategic connections to the state highway. And I don't want anybody to underplay the importance of the village, that the village in the long term. It's not just a cornered area situation. It is intended to have the potential to serve, you know, as many as possible of residents, you know, to count 10,000 people. Arising from discussions with residents, an amended set of plan provisions was provided to the council and submitted by way of memorandum dated 15 December to address some issues raised. And subsequent to receipt of the 42A report, council evidence, submitted evidence, and then again from matters first yesterday, further amendments have been made to the zoning provisions in an attempt to respond to these matters and reach an optimal outcome. And as part of the subsequent refinement of plan provisions, Jack appoints experts have informally caucused with council's experts try and narrow differences of opinion where possible and present a package to the greatest extent practicable is supported by all the experts. And I had a careful review of the experts' evidence and checked last night just to check those references to without prejudice conversations. And I consider that no amendments need to be made from my review to their evidence. Where they have referenced something that was expressed by a witness, it is consistent with what that witness has already said their evidence in chief. So it's by way of introduction to this is the issue that was raised, and in my expert opinion, this is the proposal I think that addresses it. So there's no implication of agreement, and there's nothing that was recorded that hasn't already been set out in the evidence in chief. So I don't know if people look at that, because I didn't want that to be any impression given that that was some breach.
So at the moment, probably, I mean, obviously over the last day or so, it's fairly clear that the council and Jack's Point entities have come relatively close.
Very close. Yeah.
The main point, the difference now is RCL, isn't it? That's the one that's where there's a significant...
Oh, I wouldn't call it significant. There's just some consistency issues that we're trying to tidy up, and I'll try and explain those further. Where there's just some things that don't add up in terms of minimum lot sizes versus density and how the plan works smoothly. Yeah.
Okay.
And then separate to that is in terms of, on behalf of the residents in particular, in terms of density. So that is an issue from Jake and RLA's point of view on behalf of some of the residents. So what I want to do is sort of summarise all of the provisions, the key provisions, as far as over money protection, and then I move on to some key issues that I want to address you about. So on the Jackport Village, we still propose that the village and the EX of the areas be merged to one village, so there's still a slight sort of difference there, with the 50% maximum building coverage. The retail, each tenancy for retail, limited to 300 square metres. But no proposed cap on the size of any single commercial activity other than retail. I'll come back to some of these later on in my submission to address the detail. I just want to run through them all, see what we'll capture. The comprehensive development plan and rule, which requires a CDP, which should be sorry. For the whole of the village activity areas to be lodged as part of a consent for any commercial, community, residential, visitor accommodation activity in the village gate of control activity. And what we are proposing to add to that rule today, to address, I think one of the concerns raised by Ms. Jones about the certainty that there will be education actually provided for in the village, is an additional measure of control that Mr. Ferguson will take through. Requirement giving council control over the setting aside of at least 2 hectares aggregate of land in the village for local education purposes. So to ensure that the comprehensive development plan does say, you know, 2 hectares of education at least in the minimum. Any development of the land within the village in the absence of a resource consent granted with a CDP is a discretionary activity. The height limitation of 12 metres. And then taking on board some of the evidence of Mr. Heath and the conversation that flowed flutter in that. In terms of tax, and Mr. Copeland will be here this afternoon on our behalf to give his expert opinion on tax, which is that no tax is needed. But Jack's point, having listened to him, if the commission is a minor turn, if we can find scope, don't object to a cap of the 9.9 that Ms. Jones has put up for commercial activities as a whole, and that's commercial activities as defined in the plan. And also looking at this Pete's evidence about a smaller cap for what he called it retail and commercial services, and it was approximately 2.1 hectares, 2.2 I think. The problem is commercial services aren't defined in our plan, but if you were to impose that just on retail, a 2.1 hectare cap on retail, that wouldn't be opposed either if you thought that was a helpful control. And furthermore, if you thought that this conversation about commercial services was a helpful concept, I think the best way of advancing it might be through caucusing between the ministers on what commercial services are as it relates to investment hat. So wanted to make sure you understood that that was where we moved to on those points to see if that helped. For the preserve home sites on what is now Open Space Golf, which used to be Farm Preserve 1, as I've noted through the informal books that yesterday, there's now agreement on 51 and 53 as well, so that means there is agreement on the 20 proposed sites that replace what was previously zoned for 34 dwellings in the notified plan. And within the OSG, the surrounding sites, the former open space corridors have been deleted and the alignment of trails have been refined, including to connect to the existing Lakeslow Trail that runs through Calvin Heights. Just double check that that structure plan is still got that on it.
Oh, just as you're going through these, I was reading them all last night and I was thinking, well, it's quite a useful basis for that decision ultimately in the sense that, you know, what is still in contention, what is not.
Yeah.
So as you go through these, it might be indicated to your knowledge whether the council and yourselves are in agreement on
Yes, so as far as I understand, we're in agreement on now on the 20 sites. As far as I understand, we're in agreement on the treatment of open space corridors, but I can't quite recall because I didn't shoot my mind to that. And then whilst we have been proposing that the dwellings, the buildings within those home sites be permitted on the condition that the restrictive covenant be reached and requiring compliance with the design and review boards and the preserve guidelines, the council still of the view that the control activity is more appropriate than we might suggest that.
Just on that point, I can understand that you could make an activity subject to a requirement for this covenant to be placed on a title.
Yes.
I'm not sure how you can have an activity status that is dependent on the compliance with a third party approval process.
You agree.
Could you explain?
So the way that it's currently framed, if that doesn't require compliance with the covenant.
The terms you've used.
Oh, comply with the guidelines. That's not used. So no, the permitted requirements is this, in the permitted framework we have, the standard is meant to be expressed that the covenant is registered on the title, covenant requires compliance with the preserve guidelines and the design review board process. That wider evaluation that I talked about before, in terms of your evaluation of how this works as a package, was considering how that design review board process works, the fact that one of the members is from CLBC, the evidence of the Iceberg State, your evaluation of the robustness of the JPRLA in its role, and all of that. So that's the full package, but you're correct, you can't have a standard that requires compliance with a completely separate protein and stuff like that. That's not what we're trying to propose.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. But in any case, we do not oppose the recommended status of control for the dwellings and the home sites, the new home sites. Land-use activities are restricted to residential units, one per site, and visitor accommodation activities are subject to resource consent as a restricted discretionary activity, which I think we all agree. All buildings are limited to a 1,000 square metre footprint. I think all of these matters are not in contention. Permitted height limit is only 5 metres. Is a significant obligation for native revegetation per site. There are limitations of networks and fencing and external surfaces of any building in terms of reflectance and colour. Outdoor tennis courts are non-complying. Subdivision is controlled with no minimum lot size, which I think is also agreed.
I go to that question yesterday and I'll raise it again. I'm not the right person, but I'll ask now Mr. Ferguson to think about the answer.
Yeah.
Why in an area, well there's two areas, the home sites, which are clearly large sites, there's no minimum lot size. And there's also USG, no minimum lot size. Both situations strike me as strange when it's a controlled activity. If minimum lot size was 4,000 square metres, I could understand that. But given that it could be 300 square metres and unable to be refused consent, it leads me to question why are we setting no minimum?
We're
getting
that
before
you,
Mr.
Ferguson.
I asked Ms. Jones, she didn't, I think she deferred on that one.
The land uses provided for in the RSG are needed to recognise the need for utilities, infrastructure and vehicle access through this land associated with other activities anticipated in the zone. And there's nothing else to add to that. And then the two preserved home sites on the open space landscape area, which was notified as MP2, there is still this little point of difference between council and us. Based on our expert assessments in terms of the detailed work that's gone into the placement of those two sites and the ability of those two locations to absorb developments and the additional controls and the restricted discretionary framework and the additional balancing by proposing non-complying activity for any buildings in the Pinchin Hill would make landscape protection areas. So as a package, our experts have assessed that the other non-managers are protected and the developments that are appropriate in that restricted discretionary framework. And that's both ONL as a capital ONL and ONL as little ONL under section 6B. So whichever one you're looking at.
The council's preferred option is the discretion for a resource consent application and no identification of home sites.
Yes.
It is useful to have now on this plan where those sites are. They are particularly 58, a heck of a long way from anywhere else, but presumably that's included looking at roading access to get to say 58, which would be a fairly long way.
Mm. Yeah, and some investigation of that you've been looking at, I think Mr. K. Parr refers to it in his evidence as well.
I just raised the point that if you're asking us to identify sites 57 and 58 in a way with a mechanism which essentially says that if we were to recommend that they go ahead, then people could build on there subject to some design controls in the plan. We're essentially then asked to do the same analysis as a resource consent application for a full discretionary activity before we come to that conclusion. I'm not sure that that's fully presented the evidence at a level that would enable us to make that, come to that conclusion. There certainly is a call from what I've read today that we have that level of evidence. Well, I can put it more bluntly. Essentially, you're asking us to provide two building platforms, which is two building platforms.
No, it's not that precise. The house site.
Two meters.
Within which the building platform will be located, which will be subject to a restricted discretionary consent. So at that point of the discretionary consent for the placement of the building.
But it still would be the expectation that there be a building here. It would be very difficult if a plan identifies an area of land and says this is suitable for building and it's restricted discretion on these very limited bases to locate within that area for the council to refuse consent, isn't it?
Well,
I
think
that
the matter of discretion are quite wide. They include
on the basis of the location. Yes. It's on the basis of external appearance. Well, I'm asking you to consider it there as the place that's making Calloway. And if your client was refused consent and you went to the Environment Court, you would say this has been identified on the plan as being suitable for a house site. Well, why isn't that your client?
And in regard to that, it's the evidence that
supports that conclusion, but I don't know that the expert evidence actually covers sufficiently the amount of information that we need to reach the same conclusion. I think we face the same difficulty that I faced when I dealt with the Sharp Ridge application, that we have a lack of information as to the potential effects of buildings on those sites. We have some landscape analysis, but it's not focused on those particular effects. And we don't have any particular landscape analysis of the effects of access to each of those sites, where it may be located, what it would look like, how it could be dealt with. Those matters are quite important in terms of defining these areas.
I mean, it is important
you
have to do your duty in the section 6C in the wider round. At the end of the day, for you to evaluate the weight of the evidence and the detail and determine whether or not you've given effect to either the policy requirements in respect of O&L's under the plan, or if you determine that it's a section 16 O&L matter rather than a capital O&L matter, that you have in proper regard to section 16. Right. So, yes, so that is sort of a point of difference between us and the council. Moving down to open space landscape, there was some conversation yesterday about the status of farm and recreation buildings. yeah, Jack's point proposes that where it's open space landscape or open space goal, whether or not it's also overlapped with the O&L, which some of our open space landscape does, that the activity space for farm buildings and buildings associated with natural recreation are controlled. And on my reading of the, being a sort of detail which I actually cover later on, my reading of the plan is notified farm building status, activity status is consistent with the plan is notified in terms of O&L, which is that farm buildings are permitted in fact.
Provided there's 100 hectares.
Yeah, yeah, 100 hectares. Which again is being assessed in detail from that kind of marine resource area study that both Mr. Darby and Mr. Kakari and Ms. Bringer referred to for its ability to absorb developments and not impact on the landscape area.
So are you suggesting that the preferred locations or more suitable locations than others?
Well, yes, so where it's classified as OSL rather than National Landscape Protection Area or Landscape Protection Area. Yes, the OSL area because they are the gullies and because of the relative viewpoints and so on, do have the ability to absorb developments, whereas the other ones would propose non-compliant.
Just a question relating to farm buildings. I know there's been a bit of a debate between Jacksonville and the council with previous evidence about how liberal a rule framework should be for farm buildings. I think at least George application I was involved in, given this in the future, even more desirable place to live. I wonder if the restrictions on farm buildings need to be reasonably robust, because one could easily put up a large farm building and then come along later and start by converting to a dwelling and say, well, the building's already we're there, the effects of the environment already exist. So there is a bit of a risk of that happening. I've seen it happen before elsewhere in the country.
Right.
So at this stage, it's still so you do have a fairly liberal framework of farm buildings. And the reality is that on this piece of land, there's not likely to be much of a demand for farm buildings, as far as the landowner is concerned.
Well, at the moment, under the structure plan, any activity on the OSL has to be in accordance with the structure plan explanation, which is related to farm activities and outdoor recreation. So any activity that is associated with that is a breach of the structure plan and therefore a fully discretionary activity. So then that protection built in there as well for misuse, if you like, of the planning framework.
How many buildings do you need for the amount of machine?
That was
Yes, but it's also the outdoor recreation aspect of it.
But if you're on a bike, why do you need a building?
Well, who knows what outdoor recreation activities that land could be used for in the future that are appropriate and that require a small support building.
That won't be scary.
No. I mean, I guess the other point to note is that no party has opposed those provisions. They are there in the operative plan as well. Mm-hmm. It's part of the vision of the zone in terms of enhancing the usability and accessibility of those outdoor areas for residents and the public, because the trails are public and not just restricted to residents. Mm-hmm. So it's been part of the framework since the start. And it's even sort of reflected in the vision statement in that 2003 deed signed by the council in terms of natural values and recreation values and these things. It all ties in.
Okay, so in terms of your paragraphs 36 and 37, what's the position, your position about that of the council at this stage?
We're on the same page in terms of status of farm buildings and recreation buildings in the open space in Ripon Gold. We're close.
Anyway, we can identify that later, but I'd like to have it identified so I know where we stand.
No, good. The position of let's get the section area of single buildings are not complying other than farm and recreational buildings which are controlled in OESL as far as that
area. Is that correct? You said in the previous statement that outside of that they're controlled.
No, sorry, that's a mistype. Other than buildings related to farming or recreation activity, should have been buildings that are non-compliant. Then the land protection areas. So we're still proposing the control activity status for the farming and recreation buildings.
In the land protection areas. Right, so that...
Then the other building is non-compliant.
So 30 structures then might have crossed out outside of the OESL plan.
Yeah, cross out which are controlled in the OESL. So no, cross out in the OESL.
I'm confused.
So paragraph 38.
When I questioned you about that, you said that if the gully was outside of the landscape protection area, and that's where farm buildings would be controlled, and then in paragraph 38 you say that in the protection area.
No, sorry, we got confused. In the landscape protection areas, farming and recreation buildings are still controlled.
Right.
But all other buildings are non-compliant, which is more stringent than the rest of the plan, and no one else.
That's all, cross out.
Yeah, that's the discussion.
Cross out.
Yeah. Subheading RHDSH3, which is the new activity area replacing the Education Innovation Campus. So that has been deleted and replaced, and anticipated use is recreated residential activities. Residential density shall be between 12 to 24 units per hectare head and the maximum height.
So Trump thinks, should we change that 22 to 24?
Oh, what did I say?
24.
I mean, 22.
Okay.
And I understand that that's agreed with the council as well. For RHDF, which is now split into FA and FB, I understand that Dr. Reid now supports that position, but I can't recall if Ms. Jones updated council's position in respect of that, so that's probably still a matter to be clarified at the appropriate time.
Just a quick question there, is there any difference between RHDFA and the RHDG to the north? Is it essentially the same? That's just normal residential density, isn't it?
Yes, there's. So it may be some efficiency
here.
Yeah.
Yeah, just curious.
And then for RHDG, again, I think Dr. Reid agreed with this position, but the evaluation of the council's formal position will be confirmed at the appropriate time. But the proposal was an average density of 2 residential units per hectare.
So is that essentially the same as ABC and B?
Yes.
So we get another efficiency.
For RHDE, which is a matter I'll explain in the next section of my submissions, a proposed change to the density of to 24 plants per hectare to bring it in line with the, to make it consistent with the minimum lot size rules, both in the subdivision chapter and the chapter 41. And I don't think we've heard council's position on that yet, so that's sort of been deferred. And then I've summarised the activity space for visitor accommodation in all activity areas as supported by Jack's points, with a lodge activity area, BA is a control activity, within the home site, restricted discretionary, within the village, it is controlled as long as it is accompanied by a comprehensive development plan for the whole village area, and within all other activity areas, fully discretionary. And the change to note there is it is notified visitor accommodation in the RHD areas was restricted discretionary, but fully discretionary in the RHAP area. So for the reasons that the witnesses set out, consistency across the residential zones is preferred. And again, council wouldn't have had time to evaluate that change yet, so that should be concluded.
Could you just remind us of physical accommodation? At what point does using private property fall into the category of physical accommodation?
Not off the top of my head, but Mr. Ferguson will get that from thought. We might know.
Probably because of the duration of stay and the use of
Yes. Yes. If I can.
And then the summary of commercial and retail activity in all activity areas I've tried to get out, and I'll update this in terms of what we've accepted as part of Mr. Heath's evidence. So as a result of consolidating the EIC into the village post 3 February, it was determined that further consequential changes are required. The commercial and retail activities are proposed to be provided for on a zone-wide basis as follows. Any single retail activity caps to 200 square metres in all activity areas except the village. Any single retail activity caps to 300 square metres within the Jack's Point village and RD above that cap. Total commercial activity in RHD and RHDSH capped at 550, which is what was notified, and you know, I don't think it's changing that. Commercial activity in the village is controlled as long as it's with a comprehensive development plan. And commercial activity in the remaining activity areas is discretionary. And then the additional caps that we don't object to for the village are the 9.9 hectare cap for all commercial activity if it's defined and planned. And breach of that discretionary.
Yes.
Yes. And the for retail, having for a cap that's consistent with the team's recommendation of 2.12 hectare in the village.
So he's 2.12 car parking. So is your cap include the car parking associated with the
retail? No, our assumption was on the basis that it was a GFA.
Because I asked specifically after this.
Right, okay. No, we didn't put that up as an opportunity. So
we
probably
passed. That's about 1:1.
Right. No, what we determined was the 2.1 was appropriate GFA.
Right.
In terms of the residential activities and residential activity areas, I don't understand there's any difference between Council and Jack's points on that framework. And I just note the point D that well, that should be RJB, not JJB. In addition, the RJB areas are bound by the primary covenant and memberships of JPRLA to comply with the design review board process in compliance with the current design guidelines. So that is a relevant matter for you.
Yes,
sir. Yes, I should note this. In terms of how the integrated package works and can handle it. In terms of mitigation of views from the state highway, there is a standalone rule relating to the design of state highway mitigation measures, having regard to the nature of the approximately three different activity areas of frontage to this area. Within the highway landscape protection area, all buildings are discretionary. Design of the state highway mitigation is a controlled activity, and any subdivision or development prior to approved state highway mitigation being implemented is a discretionary activity. And planting which obscures views from the state highway to the mountain peaks beyond requires discretionary consent. And
just he would be a delight to administer, I imagine.
Is that based on mature? Actually, the maturity of the plants or new planted or?
Rather than me trying to answer that on the fly, I think we'll give Mr. Bruce some time to look at that.
Yes.
That rule as well.
Mm.
And then Mr. Bruce to look at it too.
You might like to think about the time it takes for them to mature.
In terms of access to the zone, there are three state highway access points now proposed with a structure plan, which are not contentious. Everyone is in support of those. And as a result of considering the evidence of Mr. McColl for NZTA, we are tabling today a revised set of provisions regarding access to the zone in respect of the Woolshed Road intersection in particular. So as acknowledged by Mr. McColl, there is no need the trigger is notified, has been superseded by the new consent, and his position was that well, there either needs to be some modelling and a trigger or discretion reserved so that those traffic generation and protection of state highway can be tested at the appropriate time. So Mr. Ferguson will be proposing a bundle of provisions that do just that and add a measure of control and discretion to the relevant rules where it fits. Two activities that are likely to generate traffic that will use that escort.
Yeah. So I just wonder about that because Moorshed Road is a legal road at the moment.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, yeah. So I could drive down there any time I like.
You could. You wouldn't get very fast, but you could. So that's because that's the new package, the council wouldn't have evaluated that yet, nor is NZTA, so we'll see there what their view is on it. Of course. And then there's the retention of the OSL land that was sought to be rezoned to OSCRA and then modified subsequently. And simply draw your attention to the evidence, particularly from Mr. Coburn, that shows that land is currently serves a very important infrastructure purpose for the discharge of wastewater, of treated wastewater, subject to an easement and no RC consent. And so there just doesn't seem to be any compatibility to rezoning that land for school based on the current use of the land.
Is that land actually owned by us?
Yes, it is, yeah. So subject to an easement in favour of JPRI. So the extent of that easement is shown both the pen to Mr. Kumay's evidence and I think Mr. Coburn's evidence. And then right to the north of the zone, there is the OSL land, which a submitter called Devo Capital sought to be rezoned to Village Wallshed Road. And it's located within the Highway Landscape Protection Area, and on the western side of Wallshed Road is Village Wallshed Road and Residential Wallshed Road. That's what they sought. The submission includes no specific provisions other than the requirement of an outline development plan process to be applied to the area. And so this rezoning is opposed by Checkpoint. Furthermore, the submission does not provide sufficient detail for a decision in favour of the submission to be accepted, and the submitter has not lodged any evidence or intention to appear in support of that submission. Under section 41(c)(7), you have the ability to strike out submissions that are frivolous, disclose no reasonable cause, or that would otherwise be an abuse of the hearing process to be allowed to be taken further. And in the circumstances, it seems appropriate to leave such a material submission live, when no case has been presented, and we request that the submission be struck out and the meet the ground set out under section 41(c)(7).
What about the possibility that they might want to be heard in the mapping hearings?
It doesn't change the zone boundary that they've been hearing in relation to the change of the zone boundaries. It hasn't changed that. It's within the zone, it's not an extension of the zone. It's just another change to an activity area like the rest of the submitters are seeking. So I don't think it would qualify for the mapping hearing.
I suggest that if you seriously want me to strike that out, that you lodge a memorandum setting out in full the reasons and justification. I don't think I'm not going to do it just on this.
On the fly?
Yeah.
Okay, well, I'll update you in terms of a decision on
that.
Yeah.
Okay.
There's
no way.
Yeah.
I'm busy this week.
Are you? Yeah. No, you do get, you, that decision does have to move out during the hearing, but the hearing is probably on the district plan review goes on for some time. So,
well,
but I will update you in about it later.
By the 3rd of March, the council should have received notification from more people who want to be heard in the respect to the mapping hearings in this area.
Right.
So, that may put you in a better position in terms of that request.
Then the next section of my submissions just puts these submissions and the circumstances in context of the wider submissions by Checkpoint and also some other submissions that we adopt from Derby Planning Limited. Checkpoint submitted and presented evidence of legal submissions on Hearing Stream 04 in respect to subdivision, Chapter 27 and Hearing Stream 05 in respect to noise, and proposed integration with Relief Store for Chapter 27 and 36 is addressed in Mr. Ferguson's evidence. Check as well as in the summary. Checkpoint adopts the legal submissions evidence presented by Derby Partners Planning LP, submitted number 608 in Hearing Stream 1, which is the strategic direction of urban development and landscape chapters, and the integration and relationship of the relief sort is addressed in Mr. Ferguson's evidence as well. And so to understand the full fit planning framework being advanced by Checkpoint, one needs to also be familiar with the relief sort and those related hearing streams, which Mr. Ferguson summarises for you. So now move on to some of the issues in more detail. The issues that I consider are standing out in the submission. So in respect of the village, the ultimate aim is to have a set of provisions that enable and incentivise the creation of a vibrant, successful heart of the Checkpoint community, providing for the majority of the residents and visitors' needs. An agreement between the parties, visitor accommodation and high-density residential mixed uses is a key function of the village. The proposed visitor accommodation and RHDE in particular is consistent with ensuring cohesion in the village. In terms of the scale of the village overall, it is important to bear in mind that the village is now proposed as effectively a reduction from the operative position and a reduction from the notified position. As detailed in the evidence of Brett Thompson from paragraph 27, the operative plan had two village areas for Checkpoint and Henry Downs with a total of 28.95 hectares. The notified DPA in the village, the EIC and the education and health activity areas totaling 37.04 hectares. Having considered the expert evidence of council in particular relating to urban design and retail economics, the EIC E and D is now consolidated into one village area of 26.8 hectares, a large portion of which is also envisioned for education, not commercial or retail. This is a decrease from the operative position, and when one looks at the zone as a whole, a decrease from the notified position in terms of land available for commercial, retail and community activities.
Can I just interrupt you there? In all this discussion of the village and even the caps and all, no one has mentioned the Homestead Bay village. And
no.
And as I read the rules, the village rules would apply there too, wouldn't they? And Mr. Ferguson's not in any room.
That's right. I mean, we have not turned our minds to that as our focus is on the Jackson village.
But isn't that a complication in terms of the statement that the cap, from an economic point of view, is appropriate when there's a large area just down the road, which presumably is uncapped, but would be able to have all the same uses? Or is the intention that the cap apply across both village areas?
Our proposal was that cap applies to the Jackson village area. Because that is what we evaluated. So not being as generous,
I understand that, but I'm trying to think of what the implications are for the entire zone, not purely for Jackson Point for that.
Well, that's definitely a question for the experts, for Mr. Heath and Mr. Crockland, and I don't know how much they are calling it an economics expert, but for them to give you their opinion on it. So our focus has been on ensuring that the Jackson Point village has got the appropriate planning framework around it to make it work. And just adding to chapter paragraph 67, just reminding you that to give more certainty in terms of the education component of the consolidated village, we've drafted an additional measure of control to ensure that at least 2 hectares is set aside in the comprehensive development plan for local education needs. And the concept of the controlled activity framework of the comprehensive development plan, which was advanced by the Section 42A writer, that concept is now supported by Jack's points, is working, and we've modified it a little bit in a way that we think makes it work better. But in principle, we support that change. And what Mr. Darby will actually talk you through some more in terms of confidence in the quality that results from controlled activity rule and a comprehensive development plan framework is the fact that right now the existing zoned village is subject to a consensus outline development plan, which is different words for a similar thing, that is a very comprehensive consent document as part of the existing environment, and it is partially implemented through features such as Lake Tiwara, which is part of it, the Gulf Clubhouse, which is part of it. So the village itself is already subject to a consent that uses the exact framework to get it out. So Mr. Darby and Mr. Thompson will be able to take you through how that concept works so that you can see and have confidence that this framework is the appropriate framework for the village and for the developer to develop the village at its optimum, in its optimum way. We can see no justification for a higher activity status because we've seen it work so far, and we can see no justification for the need for even plan change instead. So those witnesses will take you through their confidence in that framework and explain to you why. Moving on to caps again, as notified, the EIC contains no cap on the size of any single commercial activity, and throughout the zone, the notified zone caps any single retail activity at 200 square metres. And this regime is generally carried through to the village provisions to ensure individual commercial non-retail activities, such as offices or restaurants, are not unnecessarily restricted in size, and to provide slightly more flexibility within the single retail activity in the village, capped at 300 square metres. The village also has significant potential to meet currently unsatisfied demand for quality visitor accommodation in the district as visitor numbers continue to climb. And then there's the additional acceptance of the 9.9 hectare cap generally on commercial that's come about, and the 2.1 GFA cap on retail derived from the city developments.
Yesterday I asked about subject of the caps, you probably recall, and there was a figure of 200 square metres. The 300 square metre figure, is that the cap for an individual that you're seeking, and there is scope for that, is there?
When you look at it in the ground, I think that there is, given what we had, everything that's moved, and consolidated the village, changed the EIC, looking at the village as a whole to make it function as it's intended now as a consolidated centre of the town, and the difference in effect in terms of a 200 to 300 size retail activity, I think that there is scope for that.
So would the scope be provided by the fact that in the EIC, the provisions are being transferred across, there was no cap?
No, there was a cap, to be clear, there was a cap of 200 square metres for retail in the EIC, but there was no cap for every other commercial activity.
Okay.
So it's more when you look at it in the round and you look at the effects of the change, I consider there is scope.
Can we create scope just by looking at things in the round?
When you look at the difference in effects and the rest of the changes that are made and the consequential considerations that have to be brought to bear, yes, you can.
Well, what evidence do we have specifically on the difference in checks between the 200 square metre and the 300 square metre retail?
Well,
as a cap.
As a cap.
I don't recall there being any, but I agree.
There is not a great deal. Mr. Thompson does touch on it briefly in his summary to give you an example of what difference it makes.
So there's not a lot for us to rely on in that part of
your submission. In terms of volume,
in engine substance.
Yeah, we might touch on it as well.
Substance, I'm more concerned about volume.
Yeah. But Mr. Thompson does go into a little bit of detail about that in his summary. Paragraph 17, the experts confirm these provisions give confidence that the village area as a whole will be carefully designed and laid out so that both internally and with view from the outside, a very high amenity value is retained and the surrounding open space and landscape values are not compromised. The consolidation of commercial, retail, community, residential and visitor accommodations in the village area maximises the opportunity for creation of a vibrant, mixed-use centre, object point to meet the residents' and guests' needs. Moving on to the RE activity area, the proposed change to the density for RE serves two functions. One is to address concerns of residents in respect of density that was raised by JPRI and then some of the other individual residents' submissions. And the other, once we look at it closely, was to get better correct misalignment of the plan provisions as they relate to lot size versus density. So the lot size provisions, both in the subdivision chapter and the chapter 41, trigger a different activity status once it becomes about 380 square metres. And that doesn't align at all with the density range that was notified for our HVD. So this will be explained better by the planners and the other experts, but I just wanted to sort of paraphrase the process that we went through to realise. And it came about when we were trying to figure out how to assess yield so that you can look at the destruction needs and so on. And the disconnect between the lot size rules and the density rules for that activity area triggered, we realised that the plan provisions were most aligned. So that's the background to the main change in E. As I said, we didn't, because it's a recent realisation, we don't know what the council's view is of it yet in terms of good planning and consistency through the plan provisions. So that's a matter that we still need to get back from the council on And it's a matter that my witness person will talk about further as well. And then also paragraph 77, I just wanted to cover the bases in terms of stormwater. It is a relevant matter that when you have anticipating a high density, a controlled stormwater, you know, becomes one of very, very relevant matters that has to be managed properly. So just wanted to check out that there's Lake Tiwa and the wetlands that are nearby RHDE, and they are important community and natural resources, and water quality is being protected. And currently subdivision, as it falls under the control activity rule, has got the matter of control of stormwater design and disposal. So just making sure that you can tick all your boxes in terms of water quality. And also the subdivision proposal breaches the entity orders for lots of 380 or less. Subdivision becomes discretionary in full consideration of those issues, including stormwater. So I consider that both provisions, along with the relevant rules for OIC, should ensure that water quality is protected in Lake Tiwa and the wetlands, so that you can ensure you've done your duties in that regard as well, and evaluate those provisions, make sure that they line up.
I take it that the amendment there, that point, is to avoid Lake Tiwa having a stormwater detention.
Yes, that's right.
Wouldn't it be useful if that was explicitly said, rather than implicit?
Yes, moving on again to infrastructure and open space. As I touched on before, to the southeast of the village is the OSL activity area, which in part serves as important open space, but more critically is consented and used for discharge of fecal wastewater subject to the easement in favour of JPRLA. And the extent and importance of that wastewater treatment area is discussed in the evidence of both Mr. Kenzie May and Mike Coburn, and the sustainable management and ongoing efficient use of that part of the village infrastructure seems inconsistent with reclassification of that land. There is no intention to move the area over which that treated wastewater is currently discharged, so I just wanted to correct maybe some misunderstandings in terms of any agreements to move that wastewater treatment. Mr. Coburn will confirm that at the moment there is no such agreement. I think that sums it up. The area can't support an activity such as a school or also serve its currently consented purpose for discharge of wastewater. So the sewage will be there and available on that site. In terms of protection of open space and landscape values, as a result of careful consideration of points made by submitters and through informal caucusing with the landscape and planning experts, the amended proposals in respect of R, H, F and G and the replacement of FP1 with 20 carefully selected preserved home sites considered to fully address points made in respect of the need to protect open space and landscape of these areas while also enabling appropriate use of those areas. In terms of the relevance of the ONL line, the protection of the ONL, what I'd like to is that I'll hand up the drawing of the statements now, so that we've at least got some context
yes.
in terms of ONL lines or everything compiled.
Yeah. So I'm going to 10:55.
That's it.
Thank you.